A place that has four beautiful seasons, although only one of them is summer. My name is Gordon King, for those who are visitors. I'm not one of the pastors of this church, but I work a few hours a week on community outreach, and I'm taking the place of a pastor, Reese Green, while he's on sick leave. I wanted to clarify that I'm not the new youth worker, just in case some of you might be thinking that. I had a friend when I worked in Bolivia, Jaime Goitia, and after he retired, Jaime used to say, "Jubilado, pero no archivado." I'm retired, but I haven't been filed away yet. Dale, when he gave me my job description in February, he said, "You'll be preaching the August long weekend, no matter how many people are actually in the church." And I knew right away what I was going to speak on, which means I should have had a lot of months to prepare it. And you'll have to be the judges of that. But I knew it was the time of real tension between North Korea and the United States. And the two presidents were hurling insults at each other. And the doomsday clock, which tracks the danger, the proximity we are to nuclear war, was moving towards midnight. And I read these words of Jesus, and they arrested me. "You do not know the things that make for peace." Now, these words occur at a really dramatic moment. In fact, I think it's one of the most dramatic moments in the Gospels. Jesus has made the long trip to Jerusalem, and he's about to enter that city in apparent triumph. The crowd is spreading garments on the road in front of him. He's mounted on a horse, and people are shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And suddenly Jesus stops. And for a moment, it's like he's alone in the crowd, and he begins to weep. He cries as he looks out over the city of Jerusalem. So he's taking what would appear to be a moment of public triumph and of unrestrained support, and he turns it into a time of sorrow and tears. Now, I'm going to give you my paraphrase of these verses. If you, yes, even you, you people of Jerusalem, could only recognize today the things that build peace, that build security, that build a shared well-being, but you cannot see them. The time is coming when your enemies will build walls around the city. You'll be trapped. Soldiers will brutally crush you and your children. Jerusalem will be leveled. You have failed to discern that God was visiting you and speaking to you at this time. You've lost the opportunity. It's gone. So what does this all mean, the tears and the words, and what could it mean for us? I know it requires a bit of a history lesson, and I hope you don't mind if we look at what happened to Jerusalem after the time of Jesus. But I also want us to give attention to a question that arises from me, or to me, from this text. Do you think that God weeps when he looks at our world? Does God's heart break at the poverty, at the violence, at the destruction of creation, of refugees who were uprooted from their communities. Does God's heart break when he sees girls who are the victims of human trafficking? Children who are forced to work in dangerous conditions. The abuses of power that make up part of the daily life of our world, and somehow we've come to terms to living with them. Are these things that might break God's heart? Because I think it's important to see God's heart behind the tears of Jesus. Well, in the time of Jesus, local conflicts against Rome and against the elite citizens that collaborated with Rome was already starting. There were armed prophetic groups, armed messianic groups that worked in rural areas and could blend back in with the peasants. After the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, the intensity of these conflicts increased. And I think we need to remember the arrogance of power, because social studies taught us to view Rome in a positive way. And I don't want to set that aside, but there was an arrogance of power in Rome. The Roman emperor claimed to be the Son of God, Savior of the world, the Lord, and the author of peace. Now we know that. It's written on Roman coins that were used as for propaganda purposes as well as commercial purposes. It was written on buildings. It was written on monuments. Caesar is Lord. Caesar is Son of God. But the reality was that the empire only enjoyed peace because of the violence of the military legions and the oppression of local populations. And Palestine was particularly troublesome because Palestinians, Jewish people, believed that this oppression was opposed by God. And so they mounted attacks against Roman soldiers and, as I said, against people who collaborated with Rome. The situation reached a boiling point in AD 66. There were peasant protests against taxation, hunger, poverty, and the destruction of rural life. A priest in the temple refused to make the daily sacrifice and prayers for the emperor. Armed groups began to attack units of Roman soldiers. And Rome didn't respond adequately because at that time the emperor Nero had Roman Empire in chaos. But the following year, the tide began to turn. The Roman general Vespasian and his son Titus arrived with 60,000 Roman soldiers to Galilee. They seized Galilee, and then they started to move toward Jerusalem. Each battle they fought was bloody. Prisoners and survivors were sold into slavery. And as a result, the peasant population began to flood into Jerusalem as Roman soldiers approached the villages. The arrival of different armed groups into the city created its own confusion and violence. Civil violence erupted with Jew fighting against Jew, people of different loyalties, of different social classes. Vespasian returned to Rome to be inaugurated or proclaimed emperor, leaving the siege of Jerusalem to his son Titus. The city was surrounded. Anyone who tried to escape was publicly crucified. Hunger and disease took thousands of lives as Titus cut off food supplies. After 7 months, Titus sent the legions into the city. They destroyed the temple. They destroyed prominent buildings. And they burned the city. The Jewish historian Josephus estimated that 1 million people had died by hunger, disease, or violence, and that 97,000 were sold into slavery. He wrote, there was nothing left to make people believe that Jerusalem had ever been inhabited. I think that bit of history helps us understand the tears of Jesus and his words. They will crush you. Not one stone will be left upon another. You didn't know the things that make for peace. So let's move back to the theme of what are the things that make for peace. Jesus didn't stop in Jerusalem and give a 10-point program on how to make peace. But we can discern those things from his teaching and from his example. And there's lots that could be said, but I just want to say three things. First of all, peace builders give attention to their own hearts, and they cultivate an inner life of faith, an inner life of peace. Peace isn't the product of superior military power. That might be called oppression. Peace is the product of love. And love comes out of hearts that are nurtured. You can't be at war with yourself and in inner turmoil and be a person who's an agent of peace in the world. I think that's pretty fundamental. Some of you may remember the dreadful killing of African-American Christians at a prayer meeting in Charlottetown, South Carolina, a few years ago. Barack Obama attended the funeral and he spoke. And he didn't speak as a president. He spoke more like a preacher. He said that America didn't need new gun laws as much as Americans needed a new heart to deal with the issues of racism in their country. And then he quoted from the prophet Ezekiel, "A new heart I will give you, a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove from your body the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh." And he asked Americans to repent and to turn to God. Peacemakers nurture their hearts. The Hebrews would have described the heart as that part of you in which you reason, in which you feel emotions, in which you determine your loyalties, in which you decide to take moral action in the world. In a time of moral failure, David had prayed, "Give me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me." Jesus in his teaching said that good people live out of the treasure of their heart. In Luke 8, where we have the parable of the four different soils, you remember that the last soil stands for people who live productively, who live fruitfully in the world. And when Jesus explains it, he says these are people of good and noble hearts, who guard the word, who guard the teaching of Jesus, and live with steadfast endurance. I think the making of the heart is a long-term project. When I was thinking of this week, I recalled that incident that some of you will remember. Jesus is starting out from Jerusalem. He's left Galilee and he's taking the short route through Samaria. Now, the Samaritans and the Jewish people were cousins, but they weren't friendly cousins. They were on pretty bad terms. And Jesus sends a few disciples ahead to ask for what was a sacred obligation, the sacred obligation of hospitality for strangers. That they had in common. But the Samaritan village, knowing that he's headed for Jerusalem, declines to offer hospitality. And remember when the disciples come back to Jesus, what their request is? They want him to call down fire from heaven to destroy the village. That sounds like ethnic cleansing. That doesn't sound like loving disciples. And that's just a reminder that in the story of the Gospels, the forming of their hearts is a long-term project in which Jesus never gives up. In which Jesus believes that these people can live for him in the world and can represent the kingdom of God and can bear witness to God's work in the world. And that gives me hope. That gives me hope. Because we all know about our failures. We all know about our bad moments that we're not proud of. And we all need to be reminded that God doesn't give up on us. The work at the heart is a long-term project. Prayer is the place where we open our hearts to God for healing and guidance. The Lord's Prayer was a model prayer that was meant to be prayed every day. And in that prayer, we ask for the coming of God's rule in the world. We express our vulnerabilities. We ask for our needs, not for our greeds. We ask for our needs, our daily bread, the necessities of life. We admit our weakness. We confess our sins. We ask for protection from evil. We are promised forgiveness, and we lay our lives out to God in gratitude through our prayers. The way of peace begins with humility, with confession, with assurance of forgiveness, with knowing that we are God's beloved. And the peace of God in your heart is the place from which you can work to bring peace to those around you. And so I invite you to make the Lord's Supper, which we'll be celebrating soon, a time of confession, a time of celebration that God's work in your life is not finished, and that God's called you to be a man or woman of peace. Now, my second point is that peace builders or peacemakers practice love of their neighbors, of people around them. You remember the time when a scribe tried to trap Jesus, tried to ask him, what's the great commandment? When he knew that in his theology of the day, there were over 600 commandments, some were harder than others, but all were equal in importance. And Jesus just steps right into it. He said, there are two commandments. And he brings for the first time two commandments from the law of the Old Testament together. You will love the God who you cannot see with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. You'll have a passion for God. And you will love your neighbor who you can see as you love and as you care for yourself. You'll have a passion for your neighbor as you have a passion for yourself. Now, it was pretty easy to define the neighbor in the world of Jesus in rural Palestine. The neighbors were the people of one's village. But even within a small village, there were people in different circumstances. And so Jesus taught about giving food to the hungry, giving clothing to those who needed it, visiting people who were sick, visiting people who had been thrown in prison either because of debt or because of misdeeds. What we see in the example of Jesus is that he always moved towards the pain. He always moved towards the suffering. When there were messy lives involved, he moved towards messy lives. And he set us a model that way. One day a religious leader asked, "Who's my neighbor?" He wanted to try and set some limits. These are the people you love, so you don't have to love the others. And Jesus answered with a parable, a story of a good Samaritan. And the neighbor in need was someone from a different ethnic group with different religious beliefs. And so to be a neighbor required courage in deliberately crossing ethnic and cultural boundaries. So today, as we long for peace in our world, we might ask ourselves, what do our neighbors think of us? How do we relate to those who live around us? Are they welcome in our homes? Do they see us as friendly and helpful? Do we know their names? Do we know the names of their kids or their grandchildren? Are we willing to cross some borders to love our neighbors? And then what about this neighborhood around the church? How do people in Ranchlands, this area Ranchlands, view us? As a congregation, are we a good neighbor in this community? Does the fact that there are 5 Calgary community housing projects within walking distance of our church, does that shape in any way our idea of how to be a neighbor and how to welcome people into our church? It's the practice of love of neighbor is one of the building blocks for building a culture of peace. And as we prepare for communion, you may be hearing God speak to you about a neighbor or about being a neighbor. Now, my third point, and you can be relieved, this is the last one. We're getting to the end. The third point is the toughest one. People who practice peace love their enemies. Now, this isn't meant to be a statement about the foreign policy of Canada. It is meant to be a statement about those who call themselves followers of Jesus. We've seen in the series on Jonah that the prophet did not want to go to the Ninevites. He chose to go the opposite direction because the Ninevites were the enemy. And his greatest fear was that God would have mercy on the enemy. This is really tough teaching, I think. It's not sentimental teaching. It's about the way of nonviolent love, about the way of service. Sometimes we like to think we don't have enemies, but when we talk about people that represent a threat to us in one way or another, comes out. I think rather than say much about this point, I just want to give you 3 vignettes, 3 examples. And in these true stories, maybe something will speak to you. Deborah was a simple rural woman in Rwanda, whose son was killed in 1994. And she wanted revenge. And instead of revenge, God gave her a dream. And the dream was on a road that led up to heaven, a pathway. But it went through the front door and the back door of a typical Rwandan house. And God gave her the gift of discernment. She knew what the dream meant. That for her, the way to heaven would be through the front door and the back door of her enemy's home. So when a young man came and confessed that he had killed her son and asked her to turn him into the authorities, she refused. She said, "There's been enough killing in Rwanda, enough suffering already. But I'll have my vengeance. My vengeance is this. Every night you'll come to my home and you will sit where my son used to sit, and you'll share a meal with me, and you'll talk to me." The young man and Deborah became bonded in love, and they served as an example of reconciliation for their region. My second story is closer to home. Ted Fontaine is an Indigenous leader from Winnipeg, Manitoba. His life was severely wounded by a priest that molested him when he was a boy, a helpless boy in a residential school. As an adult, going into the senior years of life, Ted knew that his healing would never be complete without meeting with the priest. Without telling him the damage that he had done to his body and to his soul, and without forgiving the man. So he took the difficult action to find him, to set up a series of meetings, because it couldn't be done just at one time. There was a lot of emotions involved. But at the end of the meetings, Ted forgave the priest. And as often is the case, reconciliation was initiated not by the perpetrator, but by the wounded party. Ted Fontaine earned the right to talk about reconciliation because, like other peacemakers, he learned how to forgive. My final story comes from also from Winnipeg. Regina and I had the pleasure of hosting a pastor from Lebanon who stayed in our home while we lived in Winnipeg. He had the greatest name for a Baptist pastor, Jihad Haddad. Jihad Haddad, a great name. And I know Madge and Angel know Jihad. He told us about the Syrian army occupation of Lebanon for 29 years, 1976 to 2005. I mean, you can imagine Canada being occupied by U.S. wouldn't necessarily give you good feelings. It was also a time of civil war in Lebanon, bombings. There were a flood of Lebanese refugees into different parts of the world. I remember when I worked for the refugee board, I heard cases from Lebanon. 6 years after the Syrian army pulled out of Lebanon, there was a new invasion, but this time it was refugees. And starting in 2011, over 1 million Syrians flooded into Lebanon as refugees. In the end, they made up 20% of the population of Lebanon, which had been a country of 4 million before the fighting in Syria. You can imagine, they weren't wanted. For the most part, they weren't welcomed. They were resented because of the stress that they put on government budgets, government services, all of that. But Jihad Haddad's church took a different approach. They decided to be a welcoming place for Syrian refugees. With the help of the Canadian Food Grains Bank, so this is part of our story, food supplies were given to refugees on a monthly basis. The church was opened up so that classes could be given to Syrian kids who otherwise were going to be deprived of an education. Volunteer teachers were found. Volunteer doctors provided medical clinics. The church tried to help with shelter. They tried to help people find work. They helped with clothing. There were special church services for Muslim inquirers who wondered why Christians were doing this. Why were they showing such love? Now, Jihad Haddad's church, I want to be clear, did not solve the refugee crisis in Lebanon. They didn't solve the violence in Syria. But they did make a statement about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And I want to make one last reflection that I realize is controversial at this point in Canada. But how do we feel? You know, what's being talked about is some refugees that are arriving in Canada. What's not being talked about is that we have the largest mass movement of people in world history, and it's a global threat right now. Over 70 million people are uprooted one way or another from their villages, from their towns, from their cities, from their countries, and they're on the move. We've never faced this before. I was recently in Ireland, Scotland, countries where my grandparents came from. They fled because of poverty. This, it's poverty, it's human rights, it's oppression, it's abuses of power, it's destruction of the environment. It's something that demands a global response. But what we're getting is that we're seeing these displaced people as a threat rather than as victims. There's a popular agenda to patrol the oceans with warships, to build walls, and to strengthen borders. And I know we've got different feelings in this room about it, but I just want to ask you this. What would happen if followers of Jesus saw these people with compassion and with love? It would take an act of the will. For some of us, a bigger act of the will than others. But what would happen if we saw these people with compassion and love? What would happen if we were concerned about the issues in their countries that forced them to leave? What demands would we make on our government in terms of foreign aid, foreign policy? What would we expect of our church mission committee? What would happen if we cared deeply about those who arrived in our country? Do you think we can possibly build peace with walls, sea patrols, and strong borders? Or is something more required of us? So we've reached the end, and we're going to transition into the Lord's Supper. I just say I've attempted to highlight three things. The way of peace requires us to work on our own lives, to work in our own hearts, to ask God for hearts of flesh, soft hearts, hearts that He can speak to, rather than hearts of stone. The practice of peace requires us to love and care for people that are closest to us, around us. And the way of peace challenges us to love and care for people who we might even see as a danger and a threat, and we choose to build bridges instead of walls. So I suspect that God is speaking to you in one way or another. And as we move into the celebration of the Lord's Supper, as we think of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, I would just simply ask you to give the Spirit freedom to speak to you as we share the elements of the Lord's Supper. I'll ask those who are participating to come forward.